You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
First of the four, St. Matthew is the man, a gospel that begins with generation. Family lines entwine around the son born in Judea, born for every nation, born under law that all the law of Moses might be fulfilled and flower into grace. A hidden thread of words and deeds discloses eternal love within a human face. This is the gospel of the great reversal. A wayside weed is Solomon in glory. The smallest sparrow's fall is universal, and Christ is the heart of every human story. I will be with you, though you may not see, and all you do it unto me. Lord, thank you for our time together. Bless these dear people. May you inscribe your word into their hearts. Fill them afresh with your Holy Spirit, not just to listen, but to live lives that reflect your grace and glory. In your name, amen. So I lied. The last time I was here, I said next week, and then there was a fellow named Ashley Null who took my spot. Totally forgot about him being here. Wasn't he great? So now you got me again. What was that, Wilson? Oh, yay. I thought it was nay. good to be back with you. Although apparently you could have had Nicodemus today too. Delight though to be back, just to kind of refresh your memory just a wee bit. We are in this first year of the cycle in which Matthew is the gospel. Having said that, this morning the gospel lesson was from John. John kind of gets tucked in a few different, folded in at different times in the church year. But we are in this season of Matthew. I think there's even one of the small groups that's doing Matthew as well. I think Mel's small group, if that's correct. Anyways, a good year to be in Matthew. 2 weeks ago, I talked about some of the shape of Matthew's gospel and some of the distinct ways that Matthew refracts Jesus. Each one of the Gospels are different. They obviously are. The first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, seen together, look a lot alike. That's why they're synoptics. So that's how they refer to those three. Seen together, there's a lot alike, but there also are some significant differences, and I've been trying to point some of those out. Some of the ways that Matthew will just slightly highlight certain dynamics of the gospel. For example, he highlights the fact that Jesus gets worshipped more than maybe Mark and Luke does. I'm working with the broad working hypothesis, you can call it that Mark was written first among the three synoptic gospels, and then that Matthew and Luke are using Mark as a written source, but they're also doing their own thing too, and adding and highlighting things about Jesus and the gospel in their own ways as well. Today I want to talk a little bit more about some of the key aspects, continuing a little bit more of that story, but specifically looking at some of the key themes in Matthew's gospel. Some key themes. So, just to remind us, there's some things that are clearly that are common to all of the gospels, to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, to some extent. What is obvious in Matthew is common to all four gospels. I just want to point a few of those things out now. First of all four gospels clearly tell the story of Jesus, duh, because Jesus stands front and center of the Christian faith. That's clear. Second, though, each of them tells the story for the sake of their own Christian community, even if we don't know exactly who they're writing to. We can guess who maybe they might be writing to. Matthew, I think, was writing to a predominantly Jewish Christian community, maybe living in Antioch, Syria. Mark, I'm a firmer confidence that Mark was probably written to the church in Rome in the mid-60s when they were undergoing persecution. Luke, well, he says specifically, I write to you Theophilus. So in a sense, it's one fella, all right? But Matthew, we have to guess a little bit more where he's coming from, but each one shapes the story for the sake of their communities. Thirdly, though, each in their own way ties the story of Jesus to the story of Israel as the fulfillment of Jewish messianic hopes and expectations. Fourth, each was written at a time when the Gentile mission was in complete kind of swing, and thus they deal with issues considering the rejection of Jesus by his fellow Jews. And so that's an issue. But beyond all of that, even though the first three are synoptics, as I said, seen together through common eyes, looking a lot alike, and Matthew and Luke use Mark in their own telling of the story, they each strike out on their own paths as well, telling the same story, but each with their own concerns and emphases. So what are some of those? Matthew's emphasis, first and foremost, I think, is clearly reflecting the fulfillment of Israel's story. Matthew's way of linking the story to Jesus to that of Israel is direct. It's upfront. Jesus belongs to the genealogy of Israel's royal line, and he fulfills all kinds of prophetic messianic expectations. 11 times Matthew adds this editorial note unique to his gospel where he says, this happened to fulfill what was spoken of by the prophets. 11 times. You'll kind of hear that refrain throughout the 28 chapters of Matthew. Jesus' ministry and teaching builds on and presupposes that authoritative nature of all of the Old Testament, the law and the prophets. And during his earthly ministry, Jesus focuses on the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Another key theme, Matthew's theme of discontinuity with ethnic Israel. At the death of Jesus, the temple curtain gets rent in two, indicating that the temple's time is over and the time of Jesus, who is the new temple, the place of meeting in God's presence and his followers, has begun. Matthew presents Jesus experiencing constant opposition from the Pharisees. We heard about that, how Nicodemus this morning in John's gospel, I mean, he's a leader among the Jews, a Pharisee, a lay leader in his community, well-respected. How does he go to see Jesus? He tiptoes, as Will said, he tiptoes at night to go see Jesus in John chapter 3. But Matthew presents Jesus as experiencing this constant opposition, particularly from the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. This is so much so that Jesus begins to speak, and he uses this language. He says, there and your synagogues. He's talking about there, the Pharisees and the scribes. And when he's speaking to them directly, he says, your synagogues, not mine, so to speak, over against his disciples. And alternative stories to Jesus' resurrection, the very end in chapter 28, begin to circulate, it says, in the Jewish community that are opposed to Matthew's community. Another key emphasis and theme in Matthew is his concern, though, with all of that in view, his concern for the mission to the Gentiles, to the non-Jews. At the same time of showing Jesus in fulfillment of the Old Testament, or First Testament, and in tension with Jewish establishment, Matthew also demonstrates a clear concern for the mission to people mostly like you and I. Right? Gentiles. I mean, there might be a few ethnic Jews in our congregation. I'm not sure. I'm not aware. I won't ask you to put up your hands if you are an ethnic Jewish person. I have to say, there's an ethnic Jewish person who scored a goal last Sunday. in overtime. His last name is Hughes, but his mother's Jewish. That's okay. I'm over it. Where was I? How do we kind of see these things in Matthew? And I think we see it right first off, right out of the gate with the genealogy, and right at the very end of the gospel. Right out of the gate, Matthew opens up with a genealogy, right? Which rarely gets read as a gospel reading. I kind of wish it would. I'd like to see people attempt to read some of those names. My favorite composer, Arvo Pärt, actually has a song where he has them sing the whole genealogy. Gotta love Arvo Pärt for that. But if you're reading that genealogy, and it's worth having a look at, is to notice who gets added in almost unusual ways. But it is four women, and all four of the women, normally in a genealogy, they're not listed women, sorry to say that, but in Matthew's gospel, the opening genealogy, connecting Jesus to Abraham, the father of Israel, right, is four women, right? Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and then it says Uriah's wife, who is Bathsheba. You may have heard actually a good sermon or two on this. This is brilliant stuff. These are four Gentile women who get included in this very Jewish genealogy. Women. Their stories matter. And they bring breadth and depth to Jesus' own family tree. So Jesus has that, in a sense, Gentile blood in him. And Matthew highlights that right out of the gate. The story proper begins in Galilee in Matthew chapter 4, which Matthew sees as fulfilling Isaiah's words in chapter 9 that the people living in darkness in Galilee of the Gentiles have seen a great light. And then finally, of course, the gospel ends with a commissioning of the apostles to make disciples amongst all nations. So, beginning, sprinkled throughout the gospel, but then certainly at the end, he's got this emphasis. And what do those themes all together suggest? I think this interweaving of themes suggests that the gospel was written at a time when the church and the synagogue are separated. They're in some conflict over who are the true successors of Israel, of Abraham. Who are Abraham's children in the faith? The Galatians, frankly, blows this kind of wide open, right? Who is Israel? Matthew's way of answering the issue is by telling the story of Jesus, who fulfills every kind of Jewish messianic hope and expectation. At his birth, as King of the Jews, he is honored and worshipped by Eastern Magi, Gentiles. He's worshipped by them, right at his birth, as King of the Jews. At his birth, his baptism, his transfiguration, he is signaled as God's Son. His virgin birth fulfills Isaiah 7, that God is with us, Emmanuel. At his death, he dies as King of the Jews, but is acknowledged as the Son of God by a Roman centurion. At the same time, Matthew picks up on Mark's emphasis on Jesus as Isaiah's suffering servant and extends it to include his whole ministry, including his healings in Matthew 8, and the opposition that he's experiencing in Matthew 12. Equally important for Matthew, Jesus is presented as the true interpreter of the law, especially over against Pharisees and teachers of the law. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law have turned the law into a heavy yoke, a yoke that isn't just heavy, but it doesn't fit. And he says, "Come unto me, all ye that are weary and heavy laden. Learn of me the unforced rhythms of grace." You've got to bear a yoke, but bear a yoke that fits. And walk in step with me. It's fit. It's not heavy. You're not going to get chafed in your shoulders, bruised by the weight. Come with me. Everything is mercy and grace. It's a light burden. It's an easy yoke. Those who experience such mercy are thus expected to be what? To be merciful in return. Jesus did not come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them, he says. To bring the new righteousness of the kingdom that goes categorically beyond the teachings of the Pharisees and the scribes. This is why the 12 disciples play the role of both learners, but in Matthew's gospel also as models for life in the kingdom. Thus, for Matthew, Jesus is the center of everything. And those who follow him not only proclaim the coming of the kingdom, the coming of God's mercy to sinners, but they are also expected to live like him. And when they have success in their own proclamation of the kingdom, especially among Gentiles, they are to make disciples of them by teaching them to observe the way of Jesus, both in their individual lives and in their church communities, Again, Matthew is the only gospel that mentions the word church. It does so twice. Matthew almost certainly intends his gospel to serve as a manual for such instruction. I mean, he wants to be teaching. And teaching not just so that people get more information, but teaching for transformation, so that people might live and reflect and walk in that mercy and grace as well. I'll pause for a moment while Gisela leaves the room, and we'll ask real important German questions. Now she's gone. Okay. Just pause there for a question, a comment. I don't know everything about everything in Matthew, but I'm just wanting to kind of tease out some of these big themes, and then we'll look a little bit more closely at the shape in a moment. But any comments? Anything that kind of is that resonating with your readings of Matthew? Yeah.
I should know, but remind us.
Yeah.
Matthew, I mean, did he live in Galilee?
Yeah. Which Matthew, right? Like, there's a number of them. The church tradition, and again, we don't have, he didn't put his name on it, but the church tradition is Matthew the tax collector.
Right.
This Matthew who is, and again, we kind of hear these things. Maybe you have a really warm relationship with tax collecting agencies in your country. I certainly don't. But even more so then. But it's probably Matthew the tax collector, probably in Capernaum, Galilee, is best. And I think it kind of makes some sense. We'll go with that one. But it's one of the ones that's the harder to identify in terms of tradition. But that early on in the tradition, it gets Matthew. Yeah. Tax collector from Galilee. Yeah.
So that's why it resonates so heavily with Matthew. Mm. Is Christ reconciled him because he represented the law?
Yeah.
The law.
Yeah.
And that's what Matthew's trying to convey to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also Matthew is probably, this Matthew is probably part of a Jewish Christian community. And he's writing in ways that's going to tune, that their ears are going to pick up on things, right? I mean, most of the Gospels are always read, and so they're first heard. They're read out loud. But people, particularly Jewish people who'd grown up in the synagogue tradition, they are awesome listeners. But when he puts in those 11, this is to fulfill that which is written by the prophets. I mean, he's tuning the receiver in a certain direction so that they can hear things uniquely for probably Jewish Christian community that he's writing to.
So yeah. Could there be a stress on we've now fulfilled the law so we can move on from it?
Fulfilled the law. What when Jesus says that in Matthew 5, I think when Jesus says, I've come to fulfill the law and your righteousness will now exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. It's what the law always pointed to is Jesus. I mean, there's certain things obviously we don't move on from. I don't know, thou shalt not kill. That's a pretty good one not to move on from most of the time. But, you know, in that sense, we're not kind of ignoring that. But he's assuming that which the law and the prophets pointed to is fulfilled in Jesus. And then now we live a new righteousness that only Jesus can give. And that we can only live it in the power of the Spirit, too, I think should be added. Yeah. But fulfill that which it always pointed to, and now exceeding even that, because we've got new hearts. It's not just about counting. How many times do I need to forgive? Well, the law says seven times. Jesus says seven times. No, it's like, no, you've been forgiven. Then you can forgive. Yeah, so it's fulfill, not forget, though. I wouldn't say forget. Yeah. Yeah, Charlie.
So comment on the circumstances which the Sheba's offspring becomes in Jesus' line. I think that's particularly what I do for a living. It's very fascinating.
So Charlie's question is commenting on how Bathsheba gets into this story.
Yeah. The circumstances by which.
Yeah, you're wanting to get into the really bawdy stories of the former prophets.
Anything can be redeemed by God.
Exactly, and each one of their stories, actually, I mean, in many ways, Tamar, now that's a racy story, Genesis 38, as well as David and Bathsheba. I mean, David had her, committed adultery with her, then murdered her husband, then married her, lost the child that she conceived in that moment, broke David's heart, but then they had another child, who wasn't genealogically the first of David's children by any means, but he was kind of down the line, Solomon. Tamar, if you've not read Genesis 38 recently, have a look at it. Tamar is a Canaanite. And Judah marries into that family. He leaves his family, marries into the Canaanites, gives his son to Tamar. His son dies without having an heir. Then there was sort of this law or understanding that the next brother was to raise up seed with his brother's wife so that his line wouldn't be broken. He just abused her, dies as well. Then the third son dies, the same thing. And now Tamar, they think something's wrong with Tamar. And now she's a widow, three times abused and misused. And she, what does she get to do with her life? Nothing. She's a broken woman. And so she very cleverly plays a whore. It's by the side of the road. Apparently Judah didn't think anything wrong about going to prostitutes. And he conceives twins with her. But when it finds out that his daughter-in-law is with child, he gets indignant and wants to have her killed. And she says, before you do that, the father of the child in my womb is the owner of this belt. And that he had given her a belt as down payment and then kind of forgot about it. And here's the part of the story that's so fascinating to me. It's Judah. It's Judah, the fourth son of Jacob. And Judah, then the next we hear about him in the story, he left his family, marries amongst the Canaanites. And the next time we hear about him, he's back with his family. Because he had said, Tamar is more righteous than I. And he returns to his family. And then the next time we hear him speak, because he was the guy who had the idea, we can make some money off of our brother Joseph. But the next time we hear Judah speak is when they're in Egypt and Joseph's putting the brothers to a test. What are they going to do? They're going to abandon another brother? And instead of it being Simeon speaking up, it is Judah, the fourth son. And he says, if we don't do what you're asking us, Joseph, you can take my life. I will give my life for my brother's life. And what's fascinating to me is that is the first time in salvation history that any person was willing to give their life for another. Judah and Tamar. What a rich story that just gets briefly kind of poked at and pointed to in the genealogy. I think it's fascinating the way that Matthew does this, including these women's stories. And Ruth, boy, she gets a whole book in the Bible. And of course, Rahab as well. Anyways, it's fascinating to pay attention to some of the details sometimes. All right, we've got about 7 minutes left. Can we continue on the shape of Matthew's gospel? I think the genius of Matthew's gospel lies in its structure, which presents this marvelous tapestry of narrative interwoven with five carefully crafted blocks of teaching. So well, I think Matthew does this, that the most prominent feature of Matthew's story, these five big teaching blocks, are sometimes not even noticed because you're more aware of the flow of the narrative. For his narrative structure, Matthew, he follows closely Mark's, making a few slight changes in the order of events in the early part for the sake of his own grouping, but then pretty much stays with it the rest of the way. But the five blocks of teaching are collected and presented in sort of a topical basis. They're all clearly marked by their own concluding formulas. Each one of them ends with this formula: when Jesus had finished saying these things, which Matthew uses to make the transition back to narrative. So my point is that he's got an introduction, a genealogy, birth narratives, baptism, temptation, kind of introduction. But then he's got five sections where there's narrative, kind of what's going on in the story, teaching block. Then back to narrative and teaching block, narrative, teaching block, five times after the introduction. And then you've got the conclusion with Jesus' passion, his death, his resurrection. But again, if you're writing to a Jewish community, five teaching blocks, poof. I mean, they're thinking of Pentateuch right away. I mean, it's very well crafted, I think. It's so well crafted that sometimes you don't notice it if you read the whole thing start to finish. But in terms of the teaching blocks, the first one, which is essentially the Sermon on the Mount, that's telling us about the proclamation of the life that we live in the kingdom of God. Then the next big teaching block, narrative and teaching sections, chapter 8 through chapter 10, where we hear a narrative and teaching about the power and the mission of the kingdom. And then the next teaching block, from chapters 11 to 13:53, there's growing tension, there's questioning, there's opposition to the kingdom, and a mixed reception of that. And then the fourth major narrative teaching block, from chapter 13, verse 54, to the end of chapter 18, the opposition continues to grow. There's confession by the disciples. Who do people say that I am? You are the Messiah. And then there's special instructions that are given to the community of the king. And this is where the only time that we've got references to the church are mentioned. And then in the fifth big narrative teaching block, there's this mixed response to the coming of the king. And then Jesus prophetically talking about judgment upon those who reject him. And then the story concludes with the trial, the crucifixion, the resurrection of Jesus, the sending out of the disciples. I've already basically given a walk through Matthew, but any good commentary is going to walk you through Matthew well. Next week, when we, is it next week? It may not be. There may be a break. I don't know. I think it's next week. That one, I'm actually not quite sure what we're going to do, because I want to try to think through. If you're sitting as I do, listening week by week, mostly through the Gospel of Matthew, I mean, what are just some things to keep in mind as we're listening? I've tried to give you some of the shape of Matthew's gospel, some of its key themes, some of its key ways that Matthew highlights who Jesus is differently than Mark and Luke in particular. But I'm still thinking how to leave this class in a sense that I'm teeing you up for the rest of the year. Not just sort of in some of these big picture things, but are there particular things about Matthew that we might want to say or think about together? Here I'm going to offer a rather dangerous thing, because if you all reply, I will not answer all of them. But if you've got really a key question, or like, I think this is what we need to hear, or maybe could you focus a little bit on that, you can send me an email. If it's a legitimate question, send it to pinter@cathedraladvent.com. If it's not a legitimate question, send it to craig@cathedraladvent.com. All right. What I'm hoping is that you're getting a feel for this gospel. One of the things that in the sonnet that I read at the start of Malcolm's, you'll notice, and if you go to the pulpit, you can actually see this. Probably most of you are aware, but in church tradition, there are different four symbols that first occur in Ezekiel, then occur also in the book of Revelation. But there's four symbols kind of that herald the good news. A man, a lion, a bull or a cow, and an eagle. Those are the four symbols that then get associated, interestingly, with each one of the Gospels. And you can see them. Matthew, if you go, next time you walk by, go through the Debartleben hallway, you take a pause and have a look at the pulpit, and you will see the four Gospels with their symbol, kind of, I think, usually down below. But Matthew's is the man. Mark is the lion. Luke is the bull or the cow. And then the Gospel of John is the eagle. And they kind of, and Malcolm in his poems about that kind of plays on that. So you heard in the poem, and I'm going to read it one more time before we go, but listen to his emphasis on the humanity, mankind. He's playing on that symbol. So let me read that once more as we go on our way today. Been a delight to be with you, as always, in the Dean's class. So, again, to finish with this sonnet. First of the four, St. Matthew is the man, a gospel that begins with generation. Family lines entwine around the son born in Judea, born for every nation, born under law that all the law of Moses might be fulfilled and flower into grace. A hidden thread of words and deeds discloses eternal love within a human face. This is the gospel of the great reversal. A wayside weed is Solomon in glory. The smallest sparrow's fall is universal. And Christ is the heart of every human story. I will be with you, though you may not see. And all you do it unto me. Amen.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.